Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Perhaps no artist has a larger presence at the National Gallery of Art than Alexander Calder. His monumental mobile, commissioned for the opening of the East Building, has become nearly as iconic as the building itself. A part of the East Building renovation and expansion, Tower 2 now boasts the world's largest display of works by Alexander Calder, more than 40 sculptures and paintings spanning the period from the late 1920s through 1976 and including 19 long-term loans from the Calder Foundation. In addition to the works in the Tower 2 Gallery and the Atrium Mobile, three Calder sculptures can be found around the gallery's campus. Obus, 1972, was installed recently in the West Concourse Gallery. Tom's, 1974, on loan from the Calder Foundation, is on view outside the 7th Street entrance. And another loan from the foundation, Cheval Rouge, 1974, is installed in the sculpture garden. In this conversation, recorded on February 26, 2017, Alexander S.C. Rohrer discusses the role of his grandfather's art at the gallery with Harry Cooper. This program is coordinated with the Calder Foundation.
Welcome. Good afternoon. This is Alexander S.C. Rohrer, known to almost everybody as Sandy, which is how his grandfather, Sandy Calder, Alexander Calder, was known as well. And we are so honored, I am so honored to have you here. You've been here before, have you back. And first of all, to thank you for all the wonderful loans to our great installation, which I hope you've all seen upstairs. Yeah. So I'll just say a word or two about Sandy and get that out of the way, and then we'll have a no-holds-barred conversation.
Should I be quiet now?
You be quiet.
Okay.
So he is the president and founder of the Calder Foundation in New York, conceived in 1987, and really, as far as I'm concerned, the premier artist foundation in terms of the work that is done there, which includes research towards a massive catalogue raisonné, a biannual, every other year award, the Calder Prize, a great website full of information, chronology, images, et cetera, and lending to exhibitions, organizing exhibitions, consulting on exhibitions around the world, including the Calder Retrospective that was here in 1998 and then went to San Francisco. And most recently, a show, I'm afraid I didn't see either of these because they don't let me travel enough, but a show at the Beiler Foundation in Switzerland, pairing Calder with the very interesting duo of artists Fishley and Weiss, and the Tate Show that closed last year called Calder Performing Sculpture. You're also the vice president, why just vice president, I don't know, of the Atelier Calder in Sachet, France, which is renowned for an artist residency. And so there's all of that, and all of that includes a long relationship with the National Gallery, not only the retrospective we did, but lending works for many years, long before I was here. And how many of you remember the previous Calder installation? We had the double height gallery between the concourse and the ground floor. Yes, so that is no more. And as part of our renovation, we completed that floor, which was always meant to be completed, but Mark Lighthouser, I think, our curator and head of design and installation, had the idea of that double height gallery and stopped them from putting down those steel girders. But we eventually did it, and so what could we do to compensate for that loss? Because as you know, that was a wonderful room where you could go up to a balcony and feel that you were floating in Calder mobiles above and below. And so as a poor consolation, we have this little tower now, which is the, you've told me, the largest ongoing Calder installation in the world for everybody Absolutely. To see. So enough from me. We have a number of images, and I'll take this off the screen just so we can see something, look at something nice to begin with.
So Harry, we you said we're doing a catalogue raisonné. So
yes.
As most people know, it's a published series of books or book about every single work by an artist. We're actually not doing that. We were going to do that, and for years we talked about doing that until we got to the point of realizing it's really inefficient. It's great to publish books and catalogs and always new research and so on, but to publish a whole wall of the 22,000 works that Calder did in his lifetime would be just kind of stale. Once it was finished, it'd be stale, and the new exhibitions and the new publications and the new provenance wouldn't be updated. Mm-hmm. So we're developing an idea about how to make that a live, you know, internet-based
more of an online
kind of thing. I'm not sure if it even makes sense.
Yeah.
Because you've been to our archives and you've been able to sit down there and go through every mobile he did in 1942 or however you want to do your research. It's accessible to the people we're involved with and collaborating with. So. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure that much time and energy in publishing those books makes sense.
Well, whatever happens, somebody should take what's inside your brain and download it somewhere, because this guy knows more about Calder than anybody. And when you talk with him, that becomes instantly clear. And I congratulate you for that, and I think that there's plenty of kids of artists who don't do that, you know, or who have a difficult relationship with the great figure. And I kind of wonder whether it has something to do with your being a grandson rather than a son.
It's totally true. The children of artists are completely bollocksed up in how great the artist is. So my mother could never say, oh, this is a Calder and it's terrible, but it's by my father. She could never say that. She could only say, it's great. And I often say, this is horrible. Mm-hmm.
You said that about one of our things.
I did. I'm allowed to have my opinion, but so being opinionated about your grandfather's work is a lot easier than your father, your mother, or something like that. And we do have a society of artist grandchildren. We all have the same problems, you know, dealing with whatever it is, exhibitions or curators or, you know.
Horrible.
What's it like to work with the National Gallery? I get that question all the time.
Yeah. And?
I say, don't go to Washington, but definitely work with him.
Okay. You can come here, you don't have to be in Washington, just because we're, you know.
It's a little Geneva here.
Mall. Yes. We won't get into that. But picking up on that, I did a little math, and I think that you were about 12 when your grandfather died. 13, yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to turn back to that and you know, see if you had some sense of who he was personally that you wanted to share.
Well, Calder was not what people have written about. Until now. Now, Jed Pearl is coming out with a massive biography, the first volume. It's a two-volume biography by Knopf that's coming out in, I think, October, November, the first volume comes out. And he's gone back and done all this research about Calder's origins and who were Calder's parents. They were both artists, as you know. His father was a sculptor, his mother was a painter, and what his origins are, right? All of this hasn't been well researched until now. It's very exciting. Along with the kind of public persona that Calder had in the 60s, he had this way of disarming an interviewer by making a joke. Mm-hmm. Because, so there was one famous news clipping where he's on TV in the late 50s, I think it's 1958 or something, and he's being interviewed about his work and the reporter and the mobiles hanging around, and the reporter says, "Mr. Calder, how do you know when you're finished? I mean, how do you, because it's abstract, right? How do you know when an abstract work of art is complete?" And he said, "When it's dinner time." And now, why did he say that? He said that not because he was just a comedian, but it was a way to say, you don't have the right to ask me that question. Because it would have taken him more than 5 minutes, which was the whole clip about all of Calder's universe, right? Mm-hmm. It would have taken him more than 5 minutes to explain what is his process and what is his intuition and how does he go about creating works of art, et cetera. So he just had this quip about it. So what was he like? That was your question.
Is it dinner time?
As a sort of, yeah. He had a really nasty sense of humor. So most people think Calder was this gregarious, funny guy who was always making jokes and so lighthearted and boyish and childlike. What are all the horrible words, Susan? You know, childlike. Mm-hmm. Actually, Calder was not childlike at all. If you feel a sense of whimsy in experiencing his work, that's okay. But it's not just about whimsy. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that I go around and talk about, what is Calder's mm-hmm. intellectual component, mm-hmm. because it was beaten down in the 60s and 70s, and people focused on movement, color, and form, and didn't get to the deeper issues, the deeper meaning mm-hmm. of what Calder was, mm-hmm. was trying to achieve mm-hmm. and what he was trying to express.
So there was an edge to him.
Yeah, so I was in the studio a lot, and I'd be working on some project, and he would assist me occasionally, show me how to use tools or be efficient. It was dead silent in that studio. He never played music. He never had a studio assistant. He never had somebody by, you know, helping him do anything.
So this is the Roxbury, Connecticut studio. Yeah. We have a picture of it upstairs in that great space with all the glass and all the stuff. And you had a little corner, a little table?
No, I didn't have my own separate work area. So we had two anvils, a little anvil and a big anvil. And he said, "You can bang away on this big anvil all you want, and that one, don't touch it." Because the little anvil, he had polished the top surface of it, and he used it for making jewelry. So for hammering brass, silver, gold wire to make a brooch or something, he needed to keep it, you know, not scarred. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, boy is going to hit the anvil hard with a hammer and make a scar in it, which I did a lot. Yeah. But he welcomed me to do that and learn about his tools. As long as I was seriously at work, he was mm-hmm. I was welcome to be there. Mm-hmm. If he felt I was doing something inappropriate, it was out.
Yeah. And you do have a pair of cufflinks on, I noticed. That
I do, yeah.
From your grandfather.
Yeah.
From the small anvil.
Yeah.
Next question, we fast forward, I guess, if you want, into your 20s, and you decide to create this foundation with your parents. How did that work, and what was it, what was the process? Did you know you were going to be dedicating a lot of your energy to this at that point?
Well, after I left boarding school, I went to the Putney School in Vermont for 4 years, and I knew when I was 8 I wasn't going to college, but I liked Putney very much. It was a wonderful school, and I had a great experience there. And when I came back to New York, I painted. I was an artist, and I had this incredible epiphany one day that I could make wonderful and beautiful works of art, but I had absolutely nothing to communicate. And if you have nothing to communicate, then it was like the last day I made a painting. It was like, these are handsome, but they're of no significance whatsoever. And I stopped doing it. It was pretty much around that time that I started the foundation.
What did they look like? Just give us a little taste of that.
Well, I painted, I sculpted, I did photography, I made jewelry, lots of different things. I did do a whole large body of work of these squiggle paintings that were three-dimensional, that were cut and came off the wall. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about Elizabeth Murray or any of these mm-hmm. artists that mm-hmm. made physical painting like that. Mm-hmm. Terrible.
We've got slides later.
Terrible. Okay, good. I think they're pretty much all destroyed, actually, those paintings. Okay, so I was very frustrated in my 20s that kind of two things were going on. One was that people didn't really understand why they liked Calder. Mm-hmm. They looked at it and they that they felt it, and they felt a certain resonance, and they felt a little uplift to their spirit, but yet they didn't really understand why. And that was a big frustration for me. So I wanted to share what he was doing and what he was about and what he was trying to communicate. That was kind of the beginning of thinking about the foundation. And there was all kinds of weird situations going on. You know, when a great artist dies, there's an estate, and people do all kinds of things they shouldn't do when somebody of great success passes on. All kinds of terrible things happen. So it just seemed like something should happen. And the family talked about doing a catalogue raisonné, this one we're not doing. For many years, they talked about doing this catalogue raisonné for 5 years or so on. And at one point, I just said, you know what? Nobody's doing anything about it. You haven't hired anybody. They were looking at, you know, curators and scholars to hire somebody to do this project. And I just decided to do it myself. So in 1987, I was 24. I started the foundation. And yeah, that's 30 years ago in November. Yeah.
And when did you liberate yourself from the catalogue raisonné?
I don't know.
A few years ago.
No, more than that. More 8 or 10 years ago, we really decided not to publish a catalogue raisonné.
Yeah.
I think like 10 years ago, we thought the internet was a better base for having a catalogue of works, plus we could continue to update them all the time. Sure. Now you hear about these cases where people break into a catalogue raisonné online and change things around and put fakes in there and all these kinds of terrible things go on. You haven't heard about any of these cases. It's very, very common now. So you have to protect yourselves from all of these, wow, all these things.
We have a Rothko works on paper online resource underway, so we need to get your security team here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Well, one of the funny things in our office, people come in our office at the foundation and they see every single desk has two computers. Why do you need two computers? Well, one's for the outside world and one's for the inside world, and they don't connect. Mm. That was something we've been doing for a long, long time. I mean, we never had email, actually. My staff fought me and fought me and fought me for email. Then I had one email address for the whole office. and now it's just chaos. There's a million email addresses.
Now we can communicate with you.
Yes.
It's good. It's a good thing.
It's better to come visit.
Well, visiting this foundation is quite amazing. And scholars, you know, and curators, it's a really a wonderful thing for us to be able to do, because we don't just see the people in the desks, but a lot of artworks right on the floor and moving works by Calder, other artists. I won't go all the way into that, but it's pretty spine-tingling, sort of like our tower here. Maybe we should talk about the tower a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've just been cycling through some slides, and what you see, it's sort of a new space for us, but it's not. You know, the space was always there, but where you see the oak floor, there had just been a skylight. So it was unused space, light was coming down through it to the gallery below. What was in the space was a whole forest of very long screws suspending the skylight and allowing, on very rare occasions, for the skylight actually to be somewhat raised and lowered, as an exhibition below might suggest. And so we got in the steel beams and the wood floor and brought up the stairs and the elevator and developed this tower and the tower that now is divided between Rothko and Newman and the terrace, as you know. And you know, my first order of business was Calder Tower. We had to keep the momentum going. And so there are about 50 works in the tower, I think almost 50 works, roughly 20 on loan from the foundation, roughly 30 from our collection, so we retain a majority interest. but great collaboration, really. And with Mark Lighthouser, I don't know if he's here, but our curator and head of design, who has worked with you for many years, worked on the retrospective, and some of the some of the furniture, so to speak, some of the built-ins that you see there were ideas that Mark developed in the course of making that exhibition. I naively thought that this is such a great open space. It's this big hexagon, you know, just like the one for Newman and Rothko, where all we did was build a wall in the middle, that we could just have all these great mobiles and stabules and constellations and towers in the space. And we went up to see you, and you said, not too subtly, that that really wouldn't work. And I think Mark knew that anyway, and that we needed some theater. We needed some set design, both to protect the works, for example, to protect them, but to allow for play of shadow and to give them drama, individuality. Otherwise, it would have been just a bit of a mess. So I think that that was a good direction. And then this is what we ended up with. But I thought maybe we could talk through. These are a whole series of installation shots, some of them taken just recently by Carrie Rose in my department. Thank you.
Has anyone here not seen the Calder Gallery, the Calder Tower?
It's like okay, you can leave
people.
Now.
I'm just asking because there's a weird thing, especially it over time. So back in 1998 when we did the centennial show, I think we had 180 works in the exhibition, some number like I don't remember the exact number, 185 or something. And important exhibitions are now much smaller than that. We did a show at LACMA last year, and it was 49 or 50 mm-hmm. works, yeah. Like same number that you have in the gallery upstairs, spread over, you know, big space,
yes.
And designed by Frank
Gehry.
And
it was
a wonderful, yeah. Wonderful installation. And when you opened this space, there were so many works together. I had this awkward moment because there were some journalists, we had a press preview when the whole building reopened, but I was upstairs in the gallery and some journalists who were not happy people were asking, are there too many things? They're trying to get me to say something negative about what Harry had done. There are too many things in here, right? And I said, you have to understand that Harry's audience is, you know, there's probably a couple million people a year that come from America that have never been to a museum before in their lives. I don't know what the statistics are, but a lot that have never been to a museum before, and they come in here, and having that kind of sensational space with a lot of things in it is a way to tell a story.
Yeah.
And I think it's an amazing experience. It's very different than a lot of things. In many ways, it's actually like what you would have seen. Like
in the studio, a little bit more.
No. Many more things in the studio.
Even
more. Jam-packed.
Okay.
But you look back to like the Tate in 62, in 1962, mm-hmm. there's a Tate show, yeah. That looks actually like that. Lots of things on the floor, you know.
There were a lot of things in our 1998 show. That was
there
bristling.
Were.
That was bristling
it was,
with,
it was huge,
with
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I think I'm something of a minimalist. But I couldn't I couldn't hold back. and it really it does speak to our audience and just, you know, the importance of sharing all of this. And somehow, nobody's running into anything, and there's some kind of air traffic control going on. You know, it is a kind of experience of sort of fireworks, maybe, sort of a wow. But hopefully room to explore little nooks and crannies. So another thing that you suggested was that we try to arrange the exhibition in such a way that there would be a kind of history, a story might be told. And I thought about that, and it wasn't really possible because it still is one big space, and it's very hard to tell people where to go first and where to go second without building a lot of walls and so on. So what we ended up with was a bit of a a bit of a hodgepodge in terms of chronology.
But there's still these cohesive moments. I mean, you see the picture, those three paintings on the back wall there are from October 1930. There's some of the very first abstractions Calder made when he moved from being a wire figurative sculptor to making proto-mobiles and so on. He made these paintings, he made about 19 of these abstract paintings, and each one is kind of almost a different kind of vocabulary, and you chose to, they're not that well known. I mean, now many more people know about them, but you chose to show three of them as a way to give this.
We've got more than that. There are three in that picture, but there's about seven, I think, altogether, which we can look at. And let me see if I can get to them.
Here's one.
And these were all done in a period of
like
a couple
3 weeks.
Of
weeks. Yeah.
And one reason I wanted these so much is that I am a Mondrian scholar, and we know that he made these after visiting Mondrian's studio.
Well, Calder had this epiphany at Mondrian's studio. He already knew Mondrian's paintings very, very well. It wasn't the paintings of Mondrian, or even the theories of Mondrian, I mean, like written theories. It was the studio environment that had this lasting impact on Calder, and really the idea that a room itself, the entire room, could be rigorous and an installation. Now we think about installation art, it's easy to understand, but back then nothing existed like that. But Mondrian had everything in the studio, everything in the room had a rigorous definition and place, and extraneous things were removed. So even the pipe in the ashtray was turned at a certain angle to the door. When you first approach, you see the pipe in profile. Everything was specific. And so the cross light.
Mm-hmm. The artificial white painted rose in the vase.
Yes.
All of that.
Yes. Well, that was downstairs, rose.
So I'm the Mondrian scholar. Go ahead.
Okay, so you come into Mondrian's the little house, and you come up the stairs, and there's a little room that's his bedroom with like a curtain that pulls back, and there's a narrow little stair that goes up and turns. And then you open this almost double height space with this cross light, and it's a five-sided room. It's a strange room. And on the back wall, Mondrian had colored rectangles of like cardboard that were painted that he could recompose for compositional experimentation. That's what Calder was shocked by, that these blue and red and whatever, many whites, rectangles could be moved and transposed, and Calder suggested that they oscillate, Calder's word. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mondrian was very irritated that this young guy would suggest anything to him, including make them move. Mondrian said, "My painting is already very fast."
One of the great quotes, one of the reasons to study Mondrian, because he had wit too, which people don't know.
Well, and they both loved to dance.
Yes.
So they would go out dancing together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think my grandfather was a better dancer.
Okay, that's all right. They love Josephine Baker. One of the paintings we just clicked by, this one is maybe the only one that approaches a de style Mondrian van Doesburg kind of vocabulary. But it is remarkable to me that an artist could do, you know, these 19 paintings over a couple of weeks and almost have a compendium of available, you know, more or less abstract styles at the time, whether it's Arthur Dove or Mondrian or Kandinsky, and then just be done with it. And, you know, of course he continues painting off and on, we know, but moving from there. Well, let's back up just 1 minute, because these aren't in chronological order, so you can get a little bit of the chronology that you might not be able to get so easily in the tower. And starting with these wire sculptures, which are not part of the circus, but certainly related to the famous circus that he was making in Paris since 1926, when he moved there and operating and performing it. And these works do perform as well, or they have that capacity. Notably, the cow, and I see we do have the extra cow flop there, which is not upstairs in the case, because you reminded us that was something that we made to demonstrate the flopping action of the cow flop, which is, to be precise, when you lift the tail, the hanging spiral flop up top flops down onto the ground, and at the same time, the cow's head turns, maybe to ease the passage of whatever it might be.
So poetic.
This is visual poetry. Yeah. The udders are hanging as low as possible without touching the ground. They're mobiles. And you know, this is, you, when you think about it, he's already doing mobiles. The initials are
totally.
Mobile. And we don't even think of this as the first mobile.
Well, actually, those initials were invented in 1955, that monogram, the CA. That was stuck in there in the 70s. That was stuck in there to be a signature, so his dealer got him to sign it, quote-unquote.
This is why we bring you here.
Yeah, I mean, it was for sale, and it was never sold. And so they had him, there were a bunch of early pieces from the 20s and 30s that he had to make all these wire monograms. Some of them are literally made out of paper clips. Mm. Calder really didn't want to do it. He made it really kind of junky. This one's a little better. I think this one's copper, I've forgotten. But in any case, and then he hung it in the sculpture so you could see it was signed, mm-hmm. and could recognize who mm-hmm. the artist was mm-hmm. if you couldn't recognize it before.
Okay, great to know. Thank you. So the udders are mobiles, but yeah.
I think
barely.
Your best proto-mobile is Aztec Josephine Baker.
Yes, let's
who's, I guess she's somewhere there.
I guess she maybe is dated 30, 31. She's coming up, I think. So we'll go through these paintings again. This one is one of the most popular ones because it does relate to the wire sculpture and it gets that sense of motion and three-dimensionality with such simple means. We had fun hanging these, you know, not on the line, but sort of up and down around the room.
That's a weird painting.
That is.
You mentioned Arthur Dubb before.
Yes.
And back when I was talking about Jed Pearl and his book, it's really interesting that Calder's father and mother were very associated. I mean, they were friends with all the Ashcan artists, and so Calder's exposure to American abstraction was very deep.
And Calder's early paintings look kind of like George Bellows and some of the Ashcan school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is fascinating. Yeah. Josephine.
So this is the fifth and final version of Portrait of Josephine Baker, the great performer. I mean, she was so sensational. One of your staff members asked me just before why it's called Aztec Josephine Baker, and the answer is, I don't know. I continue to hypothesize
You'll find out.
I'll find out one day, but I've been trying to find the Josephine Baker scholarship that will prove that she had an Aztec outfit that he was emulating in 1930. Excuse me. But that, you know, the severity of his short shoulders and her nose and everything is sort of Aztecian, but not really. But if you notice, it's hard to see. Her ankles are jointed, her wrists are jointed, her private parts there are jointed, her breasts are jointed, her shoulders are jointed, her neck is double jointed, so, and she's suspended, so she turns and rotates, and she can also shimmy. Mm. So she is mobile.
If you help her.
But don't.
Yeah. And one thing you don't see here is the shadows that create two or three or four other sculptures, really, on the wall. While this is a drawing in the air, and you know, it starts to confuse those categories in a great way.
Well, the shadows are really important, but you know, through the entire period, his whole life. I mean, even the shadows of a stabile in a monumental plaza are a key component to how he thought about the position of the sculpture and its interaction with architecture. But shadows of the wire portraits, especially wire portraits that are suspended, so. Some of them are just like a head, right? Like an old-fashioned bust, like you'd see in clay or marble. But this is in wire, depicting an open form, a massless depiction of a person. And the way he used the shadow was to present a remarkable cinematographic kind of experience. Mm-hmm. Because when the wire portrait turns, the shadow on the wall comes in and out of focus. So the face in the wire shadow will come into focus and then go back out of focus, but it's a two-dimensional plane. So he used that as a way to create this effect of three-dimensionality.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. I think we do have some pictures with shadows. So another thing that happens, and this is 1931, is that he gets a visit from Marcel Duchamp, and I love the fact that these two artists, both so important, both in a way polar opposites in the art world, are visiting Calder, or he's visiting them, and vice versa, and the inputs are very important. So tell us a little about the Duchamp visit.
Well, they were much more similar than you'd guess, actually. They both had this nasty sense of irony that was very much not welcoming. We have this view of Calder being so welcoming, but actually wasn't.
Calder and Duchamp.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but they both had this ironic sense. So when Marcel came into the studio in right after this sculpture, so Calder had started a new series, which are a small panel with a motorized apparatus and then some objects that moved and did a little balletic performance in front of a colored panel. And Duchamp thought these were, you know, remarkable. And Calder said, well, what should I call it? And he was talking about that actual object, little motorized thing. And Duchamp said, mobile. And his idea was, he meant all of them. They should all be called mobiles. Because in French, it refers both to motion, but also motive. And it was a pun. And Calder thought that was hysterical and great, and described well the sensation of these motorized contraptions. Now, this is actually also a mobile. I mean, it's articulated. We think of it as a standing mobile. But it's not what Duchamp saw and called mobile.
He saw a motorized... Like more a panel, complicated object.
Yeah. Which Calder made for a few years, those types of works.
Right, right. Yeah, I meant that Mondrian and Duchamp were quite opposite.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
But
absolutely.
In terms of their position in the art world. And then the I think the following year you have a visit from Jean Arp to Calder. And just
Arp was at the opening.
So
Duchamp named these sculptures mobile and then proposed an idea for designing the card and arranged for the show at Galerie Vignon with Marie Couteli. So in the beginning of 1932, he had his first show of mobiles, and it said Calder's C'est mobile, Calder's motivations, essentially. Mm. His motions, his motivations, it's confusing.
With the possessive, his mobiles, his motives,
and
which gets totally lost in English. Unfortunately.
Yeah, it takes a paragraph to explain what it means, but Duchamp and Calder understood the game. It was a high game and a low game all at the same time.
Yeah.
And Calder made a drawing of that object that Duchamp saw, that actual exact one, mm-hmm. and put it on the card, just like Marcel had. He had suggested the whole design. So at that opening of the Mobile show, Jean Arp comes in, and he was a little bit irritated, I think, and he said, well, what the hell was it you did last year? Stabiles? Like that. And so Calder thought that was a good name.
And between the two of them, a lot of his work has suddenly been named, Mobiles and Stabiles.
It's kind of fascinating. So there's the show coming up in a few months in New York. There's an exhibition of all of Calder's constellations, including this great constellation from the National Gallery. So it's here in the gallery at the moment, but it'll be up in New York for a show for a few weeks. It's only a few weeks long, right? And that whole body of work, these carved wooden elements connected with wires, some of them are perched on the wall very high and sort of coming off the wall. Those constellations they were named by Marcel Duchamp and James Johnson Sweeney. Sweeney was curating, there's a mobile version with carved wooden elements like that. So that's the one that would be in the show. So this body of work, pretty much all made in 1943, made a few later and after, but Duchamp and James Johnson Sweeney, who was curating the MoMA show in 43, came up with this name of the Constellations for this whole body of work. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not Calder's terminology.
43.
Yeah.
So referring to the Miro series, possibly, of Constellation Paint, the gouache? Yeah.
What a great question.
Yeah.
So
okay, we need a Miro scholar.
Juan Miro, a great friend of Calder, their friend since December 1928, painted during the war in secrecy. He painted these small-scale paintings. His idea was a full-scale painting in concentration, and they're on paper. And there are 23 of them. It's called the Constellation Series. And many art historians have gone and said, oh, wait, Calder, Miro were friends. Miro made his constellations all around 1940. Calder made his constellations all around 1943. Ah, Calder was responding to Miro. Mm-hmm. Actually not.
But James Johnson Sweeney was, maybe,
in
the naming.
Well, actually, Miro's constellations were not called constellations until 1957. So what happened?
All the answers. This is what I'm talking about.
Well, I love the subject.
You know?
So
do I get a chance?
Miro painted his paintings. Well, it's kind of fascinating because, so Calder made his works, knowing nothing about Miro having made his works that were a couple years before, but the war was on. I mean, they didn't have faxes and Polaroids and emails, obviously. So Calder had a show at the Pierre Matisse Gallery. Henri Matisse's son was a great art dealer in New York and represented Calder for almost 10 years and had the show, The Constellations, in 1943. And then he had his big MoMA retrospective. And 2 years later, Miro showed for the very first time that series called Recent Tempera Paintings in the same gallery, Pierre Matisse, in New York. So it was 2 years after, even though they'd been painting a couple years before. And then André Breton made this facsimile portfolio of, well, one of them had gone off to somebody's girlfriends and was missing, but 22 of them ended up in this facsimile portfolio in 1957, and that's when Breton called them the Constellations. Mm. Mm. So,
okay.
So yeah.
And we had a lot of the Constellations in the Miro show that we had a few years ago here, and now we know that the title was a little bit after the fact.
Yeah. Well, Miro called some of his little paintings, you know, a bird, nightingale in the evening, constellation. He used the word.
That doesn't count, though. That doesn't count. Well, they weren't the constellations.
They weren't the constellations. No, when he made them, they weren't the constellations.
Yeah. Let's see what else we've got. Now, this, when I kept visiting the foundation, that's the work I really kept coming back to. And I'm thrilled that we have it here. And what I recommend you do when you see this work is walk under it, not so close that you will antagonize the guards, but walk under it and just say something. And it's a megaphone and a kind of echo chamber. It's called the Big Ear. And the other experience I had in the foundation, not so much upstairs, is that because our floors are a little stronger, but when you walk around it, the whole thing can vibrate, oscillate, to use Calder's word.
So this sculpture was made, so when that MoMA show was happening, Calder had this commission from the Arts Club of Chicago in 1942, which was a black Stabile and a red Mobile suspended from it, that the Arts Club had built this very elaborate wood-paneled octagonal room, really not Calder's style. He liked plain spaces, but they built this ornate space, and they wanted, and so the sculpture, they were building it, so they lent the sculpture to MoMA. And then MoMA, the show was so popular, they extended it into 1944, but the Arts Club said, no, we're not going to extend our loan. We want to have our sculpture. Our room is finished. Mm-hmm. We really want to have it in our room. So they had this, MoMA had this hole for this, it was quite a big sculpture, and Calder made this sculpture to fill that hole. Mm. So that's why we know the sculpture is 1943. And about 6 months ago, we actually bought the model for this sculpture. It came for sale, and we were able to buy it. It's just a little model about this big.
Mm-hmm. Does it have markings on it and rivets and messy working process, or not so much?
No, the earlier models are much more refined and finished and not sort of transitions towards making the big sculpture. Yeah. They feel quite complete. Mm-hmm. But some of the models, including this one, have little twisted wires and little special little connectors. different than a formalized sculpture. So you know it's a model, you know it's a maquette, but it has a sweetness to it.
Yeah.
Nice.
So another thing the foundation does is acquire works that relate to things you have already and just are great things to have. So, you know, if you're bidding for a Calder, you never know who's in there with you. And, you know, we have a lot of wonderful little works in that case, and this one recently from the Corcoran. And one thing about going through the show chronologically that strikes me just now is the wealth of early works, of works from the 30s and 40s, which is, you know, special.
So that mobile is an extraordinary, it's 1947, it's a very large mobile. I mean, for the date, it's incredibly large. Its title is 1R, what is it, 4N, XW.
Yeah, and which we've spelled out a little bit more.
You spelled it out?
Yeah.
Okay. So that kind of notation just physically describes there's 1R red, 4N for Noir, so because B, black is B and blue is B, he used N for black in French. And then X, meaning, I thought it was weird that he had sort of Arabic numerals and Roman numerals together in a title.
Yeah.
That was my mistake years ago, but actually X just means an open number. It doesn't mean 10, because there are many more than 10 white elements.
Indeed.
Yeah.
There are.
Yeah.
It's algebra.
It just meant, yeah, I'm too lazy to count them all. It's a big number.
I love it. That's great. Yeah. Should we change, you gave us this title, I think.
Yeah.
Should we change it to the original inscription?
Well, you know, his titles come about, this is one of the things we're challenged by, which is, what was Calder's title? So the prior slide, Calderberry, was not Calder's title. This sculpture has this line that comes up, and there's one, like a cranberry on the end of a wire. Now, if it was untitled, you'd have to bring your intellect to it and try and figure out what is the artist trying to share with us. But if it's titled Calderberry, then it's sort of like, oh yeah, it's Calderberry, and then, you know, move on to the next thing, and you can just sort of...
You know, and the idea that Calder would put his own name into a title
He didn't title it. A dealer titled it that in order to sell it, to make it charming and amusing and interesting and whatever.
Stuck. Should we unstick that title?
Well, so we have this...
We're getting into the nitty-gritty. You know, I'm working here.
Yeah.
Okay? This is important. You know, just... Hang on with us. We're going to sort this out.
So pretty much...
This is what museum work is, right?
Our rules are, if it had a title during Calder's lifetime that was recognized, like in the primary dealer who sold it in the very first place, if it was titled that in their inventory information, we keep that title, even though we're 98% sure the dealer made up the title, just in an effort to sell it, until we find some evidence that it's wrong. So with the mobile, we have Calder's own handwriting that is the very shortened notation for a list of works he wanted to put in an exhibition. And then we have the longer one plus X white, the title you have.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's...
What do you mean for
the big mobile.
This one.
That one, yeah.
Okay.
So that's he wrote its title in a number of different forms.
Yeah.
And for one reason or another, that's the one we... Yeah. determined was the most appropriate.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the criteria was.
Yeah. One of my favorites, and it's nice to see it billboard size. And I think one of Mark Lighthouser's favorites. I think he's the one who said, I want that back. That was in the 1998 show.
I want it back.
And just love the way that, as far as I can tell, those lead weights, the four lead weights have no representational function. They keep the whiskers on alert. And they also balance out the tail, right?
Yeah, and this particular photograph, you miss a large and significant aspect of the sculpture. It's a male rat.
Yes.
and if when you go up there, have a look, because you can't see it in this picture.
We have very skillful photographers.
Yes. Well, a few months ago, the female rat We knew about the female rat. We knew there were two because we have a black and white picture from Calder's archive. We didn't know where it was, but it just came for auction, and it has the mating part.
Really?
Yeah.
Right under there.
Yeah.
It
does.
Can we bring that into our case with the male one?
I hear they're just too prolific. I don't think that's
okay.
a good idea.
Stupid question.
Well, unfortunately, we did not buy that rat.
Oh, okay.
Somebody else bought that rat. But we have one rat. That's enough.
Some rat.
That's enough.
Bought
Some
it.
Rat. No. No, a good friend bought it.
Oh, okay.
Actually. Yeah.
So there are a number of these magical fish. There's one at the Hirshhorn.
There are 12 of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were made over a span of about 15 years. And the objects in the fish are really diverse. Some of them, I mean, you see that they're bits of glass, right? And they're also bits of pottery. So if a plate is smashed at lunch, he cleaned up the pieces and utilized them in the jewelry or in the fish or wherever. Just, yeah. There's also the top to a cleanser can in one of them, which is has those cutouts. There's a bowl of an absinthe spoon. All different kinds of things appear in these fish. We're very gratified this fish is here. It's definitely the best fish of all the fish. Yeah. Its arms
right
reaching
on.
Out are super groovy. Yeah.
It's also got even that little cow flop left over from the cow there.
What's that? Where's
little,
it?
Little spiral.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
just a spiral.
That.
It's an innocent spiral.
Maybe that's the original spiral.
But I love the fish, and speaking of Calder's wit, one thing that has always struck me about this is that, you know, often a fish is in a net, and here the net is in the fish. And that's just a nice play. And this has been a challenge for conservation in many cases in Calder's work. There's just string that's suspending objects and, you know, string frays. So our conservators have quietly doubled some of the string with fishing wire that's pretty much invisible. And so we definitely want to keep all the original materials, but we don't want things to fall down. So you better tell us a little bit about this wonderful thing.
So let's see. This is a cigar box recycled into this little suitcase for five little traveling standing mobiles. The tallest one there with the red base doesn't disassemble, but all the other ones come apart in little pieces and fit into each one of those cavities there. My grandfather made it for my grandmother for her birthday, and basically what was going on is that he was traveling a lot, and she might be traveling also, and that she would have a traveling case of a miniature exhibition of her husband's work if he was away or something, and could, you know, set them up in a bureau in a hotel.
Which is a very Duchampian thing to do.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. This
I love how you
48.
Feed me this, you feed
but
me
he
this
did
stuff.
It, did he do it first? Yeah. Oh, we got to check that out. But, you know, Duchamp had these boîtes, these boxes, these cases that were traveling
miniature
Duchamp retrospectives.
Do you guys all know about this?
We have one on view upstairs.
It's like a briefcase. You open it up, and then there's miniature versions of all of his famous sculptures, his large glass and his urinal and all those things. And you can pull them apart, and you can lay them out just like this, a miniature traveling exhibition. So Calder made this after Duchamp's boîte. Mm. But Duchamp made his boîte in response to Calder's circus, which was the miniaturization and the unpacking. This is Marcel's favorite part of the circus, was the unpacking of those suitcases. Mm. It wasn't even the performance.
Yeah. Interesting. And speaking of unpacking, we also got this great, the clasp is a Calder clasp. The little cigar box clasp was just not interesting. And that's much nicer. I think you had a thought about the title on this one, too.
Yeah,
or
we're
question.
Still...
question. You're working on that.
We're still working on that one.
Okay.
We can spend years thinking about a title. Sometimes we buy archives all the time, or are given archives all the time, and photographs, and we continue to build. We have about 130,000 documents in our Calder archive. And there's a letter that references, I think it references this mobile, but we're not certain.
Yeah.
So...
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that that title comes from your donor. Pretty sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who was one of the major dealers of Calder's work?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We have two of these great towers, these wall climbers. So one thing about the installation is there are things on the floor, things in cases, things that hang from the ceiling, and even things on the wall that don't touch the floor or the ceiling. And I'm so glad we have this one, which then goes along with the one that has been in our collection. I'm going a little more quickly here because I think we're basically out of time, but I'm just going to keep going until somebody tells me to stop.
But every single person here has a question, so.
They do. Yes, they do. We'll give them your email.
It's Harry Cooper at NGA.gov.
Okay. Oh, this one, which, you know, is called Triple Gong. And why is it Triple Gong? Because I see there are three, presumably those three black elements that can be gonged, but two red gongers, to be technical about it.
Yeah. I call them strikers.
Strikers, okay. And
well, the two small ones are on a wire, and they can turn. So one becomes available to be struck while the other one's out of range, and then it turns, and then the other one.
Yeah.
And they're oxidized, so they're very dark. But they were originally they're brass, so they were originally you know, gold colored, and shiny and sparkly.
And so the brass would make an especially nice sound.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
As opposed to the sheet metal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Every once in a while you'll hear it. You'll hear it go off. It's rare. But this brings up the, you know, musical dimensions of Calder's work, which we could have another talk about, and all the music that he's inspired, but also that amazing, possibly first mobile that is in the foundation, which consists of a hanging, swinging element surrounded by a number of objects, bottles, cups, sitting on the floor, waiting to be struck, sounded, knocked over even, I don't know if that happens, no, good, by this swinging element. So that is just amazing to me that there's sound and, as you pointed out, a kind of violent often interaction among the elements in the wonderfully light, witty, playful, universe of Calder, there are things that happen that are kind of shocking in a little way.
Yeah, and not even such a little way.
Yeah.
That's why it's not just witty and light and, you know. I grew up with this, I was born in 1963 and I grew up in the 60s and the 70s with my grandfather with his intellect being so diminished because it was all about, you know, the Vietnam War was on and people wanted to have lightness and spirited things, and that's how Calder's work became framed, mostly for commercial purposes. And Calder didn't have anything to do with how the work was minimized like that.
Yeah.
In fact, he stopped even giving interviews, really.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite works in the show, and it's a type of work that he started doing near the very beginning of the mobile practice. Right? The spines, although this one comes from 1956. But this too is for me a little bit anti-Calder, a little bit against the common cliche of which tends to focus on the pedals or the paddles or whatever you want to call them and their wonderful shapes and their bright colors. But a Calder doesn't need that. And I think this is so dramatic.
It has an aggression that you don't expect. And actually, if you hung that in one of your other galleries with the Abex artists, it would fit perfectly.
Yeah. And a mobile in our collection, which is just frankly not as good as the one from about 10 years earlier that we were talking about. but
no,
you know,
but
it's good.
It's actually a great mobile. I love this mobile because it's about purity and simplicity. And if you study those forms, they're not circles. You think it's a bunch of red disks and a white disk and a black disk, mm-hmm. and there's horizontality and these two vertical elements. But actually, mm-hmm. if you spend a little time with it upstairs, you discover that it's not that simplified. It's a lot more organic presence than.
Okay, I'm liking it better. I will try to do
I
that.
I like it.
Yeah. And then in the middle of the room, we have everybody's favorite. We're having our lights turned on. These almost on time. These animals, which are very late in the career, and the gift of Bunny Mellon, Mrs. Paul Mellon, and mostly male, couple of females.
But it goes back to that cow from 29 of the
yes,
udders.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. But they've become constructivist udders.
They're not as giving.
They're more Russian. We'll stop, you know, on that particular line.
Yes.
The crinkly toro, I love the crinkly toro. I'm sorry, crinkly worm. Toro's, the camel, the blue man. And the heads all move and are just sitting there.
So everyone should go push the heads and make them turn?
No. Don't even blow on them. And then there was this little guy, this poor beat up small little elephant, and we didn't know where to put it, and then I realized that if we put it right in the middle of all the other animals, it would be protected and nobody could be tempted to reach in and play with him. So he's the runt of the litter. So we had one extra platform with the animals, and so the flesh is there. And I don't know how many people notice that there's a non-animal in the zoo. And then, of course, the mobile. Maybe this is a good place to wind up, because this is where Calder and the National Gallery, of course, intersected when the East Building was being built, and a number of commissions were given, and one of them to Calder for this great mobile, which he did not live to see installed or even engineered into its final form. But we do have the maquette, the model that he made, and we have him on film playing with it wonderfully. I think the film is online, called A Place to Be, about the making of the East Building. And so that is in the installation upstairs. So you can look at that and fix it in your memory, and then rush down into the atrium and see the final product. But the mobile is just an icon of the East Building, and it has, it has required some work. It has occasioned discussion over the years, partly because it doesn't always move that much. It depends on the particular air currents and air handling of the moment. So we made an effort when the East Building opened to make sure that it was moving well. And it's slowed down a little since then, but we'll get it going again for you. I'm obsessed with this. I don't know why. We've talked about it. We have our disagreements.
I'm sure we'll continue to discuss it.
Yeah, it'll be fun. So I think we should... do you have a last word or two? Do you have a piece of...
Well, the thing about that mobile is that it's not supposed to move except when it does.
I knew you were going to have the last word on that.
Yeah, it's mobiles are not, they're not whirligigs, they're not motors,
yes.
They're not, you know,
right.
They're not supposed to be always active, they're supposed to not be active except when they are active. So think of mobiles as a painting which is changeable, variable, and should not be constantly, sometimes a museum, they have one mobile in their collection, they don't know what to do with it, and they suspend it in front of a ducting system, and it's just going around like this.
No.
And they think they've done something, magical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not so good.
Right. It's not us.
No, not you.
No, but Yes, we've had thoughts, but... No, but it goes back to what we were saying, you know, about Duchamp and his visit, and he saw the motorized thing, and Duchamp got excited about that, but then Calder really backed away from the motorizing of and discovered, and I think when he moved his, started to work outside, maybe, was it, that he became a little more interested in natural motion?
Well, the artificiality of a motorized object is repetitious. Yeah. So that's the thing Calder eventually decided to just leave that alone. But if you actually look at these early motorized works from 31 or 34 and so on, they move incredibly slowly. So slowly you don't even realize they're moving. That's how slow they move. Mm-hmm. We have one little red panel of 1934 in our office that we just restored its mechanism. And we plugged it in, or we're waiting for it to do something. It's not doing anything because it's moving at one round per minute. Mm-hmm. And this black helix that turns in front of the red panel is just static. Unless you slow yourself down and then you give it 4 1/4 minutes and then it does its entire cycle, which is something wonderful.
There's a lesson there. Slow yourself down.
Yes.
I think so. Pardon? Yes, a wonderful comment that these are interactive and they depend on people with body temperature and motion and doors opening and closing, and when there are more people upstairs, things move more. And so...
Without a doubt.
Yeah, I think on that note, we should say goodbye and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Harry.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.